From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, the Milwaukee-based Bradley Foundation takes center stage in a series by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
Then, how the members of the Milwaukee Museum Mile benefit from their coalition.
Instead of looking at us being individual museums in roughly the same area on the historic east side, rather than, you know, fighting for maybe the same visitor, you know, week in and week out, to actually collaborate and see how we could bring visitors to all our museums at one time.
Later, we bring you the latest piece in our Bubbler Talk series, and a new comedic musical draws inspiration from contentious town halls.
Going back to the title and the we know best and the sort of arrogance of that notion that the other side is all fools and we're all right. It almost seems like humor is the best way to kind of pierce that a little bit.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The Bradley Foundation is well known in Wisconsin as both a supporter of conservative and conservative-leaning groups and also Milwaukee art organizations. But what's less known is the foundation's long-term national aspirations.
Some of those goals have been coming to light through a series in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Reporter Dan Bice has shaped and produced much of that series, and he joins us in studio to give some insight into his reporting. He tells Lake Effect's Mitch Teich what makes the foundation a compelling topic to explore at this point in time.
You know, it flies beneath the radar nationally and even here locally to some degree, but they have $900 million. When I first started covering them, I started writing about them more intensely in 2011. At that time, they had $600 million. And a private charity, has to give away 5%, about 5% of their assets each year. So right now, they're giving away $40 to $45 million a year. They spread that over. Some of it's given to the arts community, but the bulk of their money goes to spending on conservative groups, conservative nonprofits, that sort of thing.
Well, and they have been around, if I remember this correctly, since 1985. Are things changing that in their MO that makes it worth looking more closely at this point in time?
Sure. We can talk about these hacked documents that have become public now. But they made a switch. Now, conservatives nationally are making this pitch of federalism to move more responsibilities to the state. And the Bradley Foundation had been well known over the years for its work nationally. It's a key contributor to the Heritage Foundation, to the Federal Society, to the American Enterprise Institute, the Cato Institute, all of these things. But around the year 2010, Mike Grebe, who was then in charge of the Bradley Foundation, started thinking about shifting some of their resources to the states and spending more money trying to build up what he calls a conservative infrastructure in the states. And since they're based here, the Bradley Foundation likes to try its ideas in Wisconsin. So what they did was they put money into 14 different nonprofits, a legal center, think tanks, opposition research centers, bill drafting groups, all sorts of things, starting around 2011. And between 2011 and 2015, they put $13.4 million into these groups. And they're not just passive groups. These are activist conservative groups that are out there helping Republicans by recruiting candidates, filing lawsuits, doing all sorts of things.
Well, and this is interesting because it kind of parallels the rise to power of Scott Walker. And a lot of people talked about Scott Walker's election and the flip of the entire legislature as, you know, Wisconsin becoming kind of a political laboratory for many kinds of conservative programs. And you would, it sounds like, contest that, or you would suggest that it's going on in more ways than one.
Right. I mean, there's a reason that welfare reform started in Wisconsin. That was something the Bradley Foundation has pushed since day one. There's a reason that school choice occurs here, why Governor Thompson pushed that proposal here. It's been a Bradley Foundation idea. They have broadened their scope to other topics. And actually starting around the year 2003, 2004, they took a great deal of interest in the issue of big labor, as they call it. And so they've been pushing this issue of big labor long before Scott Walker did it. But these groups act as sort of a support staff. Some people call it a shadow government to help the Walker administration. Now the governor will himself downplay these things, saying that he accomplishes many of these things on his own. And it's illegal for these groups to participate directly in campaigns and stuff, but they can do a lot of stuff. They can do a lot of things indirectly during a campaign. For instance, I'll give you some instances. One would be Wisconsin Watchdog, which is an online website that would do its own style of reporting. The main reporter is a former Associated Press reporter and a daily newspaper business editor. He did a number of stories on Mary Burke, very critical of her and her quote-unquote firing at Trek bicycles. That's a story that was turned quickly into a TV ad and certainly was helpful to Scott Walker in the last election.
But as you say, coordinating directly with a campaign is prohibited.
Right. You can't do that. But, the overlap is very close. I'm going to do a story on how after the recall elections, Governor Walker and his campaign brain trust of R.J. Johnson and Keith Jokes met with the donors of the Bradley Foundation for sort of a powwow at a secret retreat or private retreat to talk about how the recalls happened. So, there is a line. You cannot directly participate in election activity, certainly the Walker administration and the Walker campaign has benefited from this infrastructure. And what we saw from these internal records is that the Bradley Foundation believes that they've been very successful with this. They recently received $200 million infusion of cash from one of the Bradley family members' trusts. And so they're using a lot of that money to take this model and try it in other states. They've tried it in Washington. They've been very aggressive about attacking unions in Washington. They are doing something similar, and they're putting money into a group called American Majority that recruits candidates. They're doing that in Colorado, and they're very active in North Carolina. There's about 12 or 14 states that they're actively supporting these outside aggressive nonprofits.
Is this taking a page from, say, the Koch brothers playbook, or I guess the Bradley Foundation or conservative supporters might also point to what some national liberal organizing groups with deep pockets have already done?
Well, actually, when they decided to do this back in 2008, 9, and 10, there was a book that came out. Adam Schrager, who's now in Madison, wrote the book on Colorado on how four philanthropists, liberal philanthropists, set up a similar infrastructure there and was able to flip the state blue. And right now, the Bradley Foundation is using its resources to try to turn it back to red. So there's sort of a minor political civil war going on there. So liberals have done it. In the state, they have some of these things. You have one Wisconsin now that does opposition research stuff, Emerge, which recruits candidates just like American Majority. But I don't think their infrastructure is nearly as large or as effective right now. Mike Tate, the former Democratic Party chairman, says that they lack the discipline and patience of the Bradley Foundation. So as for the Koch brothers tend to invest directly into campaigns or in terms of doing campaign-related spending. So some people have said that this works hand-in-hand with what the Koch brothers are doing. They've set up sort of a shadow campaign. The Bradley Foundation is underwriting a shadow government. So, it's similar, but it's different. It's filling a niche that others haven't filled before.
Talk about how the foundation's practices came to light, these documents that were leaked.
It was a weird thing. In late October, someone posted, a group called Anonymous Poland posted online that they had gotten into these records. And Anonymous Poland claimed to be part of the Anonymous Hackers Group. That doesn't appear to be the case. But what they did was they got these files. They inserted three forged fake documents. They had no idea what the Bradley Foundation was. And so they tried to say that the Bradley Foundation had illegally given $156 million to Hillary Clinton through these letters. The money came through its asset manager, Rothschilds, which sort of fit a conspiratorial idea that the hackers had. So they put those things out there. It had no impact. The story went away. And they had the records online for about 4 or 5 days. Someone made copies of this stuff, which is infected with viruses, malware, and all that sort of stuff, and gave it to me not a long time ago. And so we just started going through them. So it's 56,000 files, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of records. A lot of them are personnel-related stuff, and I've not touched that just because I don't think people care how many sick days certain staffers took. A lot of financial records in there, too.
As you say, there were also some forged documents, so
there
how do you go about—
There were the three forged documents, but once you start looking at it, I knew pretty immediately that these things are real because the Bradley Foundation is open and publishes a report of all the most of the grants that they give out, and so I was able to look at the internal grant-making process and to match it with what they were doing externally. Plus, I know a fair bit about the Bradley Foundation, and a lot of the stuff rang true. I mean, some of the basic stuff that a forger would not think to do, such as Mike Grebe, the then CEO's, had a list of people whose calls would be patched through directly to him if they made them. And so I know his family members. He's also the chairman of the Walker campaign. So Scott Walker's on the list. His former campaign manager's on the list.
There's also an enemies list that shows
there
up.
There is an enemies list of it's 17 different groups. You're not on it. Sorry about that.
And nor are you.
I'm not on it either.
Not yet, anyway.
And it's a list of – the board had asked for a list of groups that were thwarting the conservative movement. And so the staff came up with 15, then 16, and then eventually settled on 17 groups. I published that over the weekend. And a number of liberal groups are happy to be on it. So I'm expecting people to have campaign fundraising mailers that make mention of the fact that they are on the enemies list for the Bradley Foundation.
Now, if the Bradley Foundation serves as something of a shadow government and the Koch Foundation serves as something of a shadow campaign, is there any indication that that strategy might be changing, that the Bradley Foundation might be getting more into the business of direct involvement with specific politicians or specific candidates?
In their grant applications, they are I should say they are not directly involved in any of this stuff. Their influence is in terms of deciding who to give money to and who not to give money to. And when you go through the grants, you can see that they are very involved in managing the process. They're not telling them what to do. But, for instance, on the John Doe investigation, several of these groups in Madison, the conservative groups they fund, attacked the John Doe. And one outlet wrote 400 critical stories of it. And that's noted in the grant review saying that they had done a good job in exploiting and exposing the John Doe. So they have a hand in and an indirect hand in how these things are carried out. But they're not specifically telling them, you need to do this, you don't do this. They also fund the American Majority, which does recruit candidates. And that one, to me, is the most peculiar one because you're getting pretty close to the campaign line when you're doing that. But in their records, they say they're not recruiting Republican candidates. They say they're recruiting pro-freedom candidates. So that makes it permissible, apparently.
Well, how does the foundation's political work relate to the work they do with arts and other charitable groups in Milwaukee?
Until we saw these hacked files, we didn't have any sense of how it affected. And for the most part, much of what they're giving to the arts and cultural community in Milwaukee is basically to make sure it's thriving and okay. But there are specific instances in which their political views did have an impact, most notably with the art museum. The art museum a couple of years ago had a portrait called Eggs Benedict that was of the Pope made out of condoms. There was a lot of controversy over that, but we didn't know that the Bradley Foundation went over there, basically told them to take it down. The art museum said no. And so the Bradley Foundation withdrew its grant.
$90,000
and hasn't given anything more to them since then. They say that they're not holding that against them. There's just not been the opportunity since then. But obviously that was an impact. With the public museum, they haven't cut funding there. But in their records, the staffer wrote that you need that they needed to track and monitor the new director's political views. It doesn't say exactly what they are, and the Bradley Foundation has been reluctant to give any details on that. My guess from reading the document is they have concerns that he is a supporter. He believes that there is such a thing as man-made climate change. And it's fair to say the Bradley Foundation is a skeptic of that. They fund a number of groups that are skeptical of that. One other thing that I don't think anybody knew outside of the Milwaukee Symphony was that they had given a $15 million grant to them to help them move their location. It's the second largest grant that they've ever given. And their largest grant was actually a loan to the Milwaukee Brewers for the stadium. But that was quickly transferred into a grant. So that was $20 million. This one is $15 million. So, I mean, they're a major player in the arts community here. There a lot of the analyses in these documents gave us a window into how well some of these different groups are doing or not doing. I mean, there's some that they're very critical because they're, you know, underwater, not doing so well. On the other hand, groups like the Milwaukee Ballet doing very well, and they're happy to underwrite a group like that.
Well, it's interesting stuff. And Dan Bice, we'll keep reading.
Sure. There will be many more stories. We hope to have another one on climate change, maybe one on their funding for groups that oppose same-sex marriage, traditional family values. So those stories are still to come.
Dan Bice is reporter and No Quarter columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. You'll find a link to the newspaper's ongoing series on the Bradley Foundation at WUWM.com.
Coming up, visitors to Milwaukee's East Side will be in for a special treat this week. We'll have more when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Joy Powers. Over the next 10 days or so, visitors to Milwaukee's East Side might notice many painters outside. They're not commercial house painters, rather they're artists. They're producing works of art as part of a plein air competition, sponsored by a coalition of museums on the city's East Side.
The Milwaukee Museum Mile is comprised of five museums, which are arrayed on the bluff above the lakefront. They'll celebrate Milwaukee Museum Mile Day on Sunday. Kevin Walczak is on the board of one of those museums, the North Point Lighthouse.
He joined Lake Effect's Mitch Teich in the studio recently and explained how the Museum Mile has evolved since its inception.
So we started 7 years ago as a concept, a consortium of five small to medium-sized museums on the east side, historic east side. They comprise the North Point Lighthouse, Charles Alice Art Museum, Villa Terrace Art Museum, Jewish Museum Milwaukee, and St. John's on the Lake, which actually has a gallery for the Museum of Wisconsin Art on its atrium level. And that's how they're involved.
And remind us why it was important for this alliance to come about.
So the idea originally was to figure out how these small to medium-sized museums who are all operating on their own budgets, working very hard to attract visitors to come to the museums, how could we leverage a collaboration, a consortium of these museums? And so a group of us got together and said, why don't we just put together this sort of consortium, which, you know, doesn't have any legal aspect to it other than just a concept, and then use that concept to help market our museums in another way. You know, not just on our own efforts, but in another way through the Museum Mile.
So it's an alliance more than a competition in that way.
It's exactly. It's what it is. It's a collaboration rather than a competition. So instead of looking at us being individual museums in roughly the same area on the historic east side, rather than, you know, fighting for maybe the same visitor, you know, week in and week out, to actually collaborate and see how we could bring visitors to all our museums at one time.
What do you see is in it for the visitor?
Well, I mean, they're wonderful art and history museums that a lot of people really don't know about. Now, we're hopeful that after 7 years, the Milwaukee Museum Mile has helped create more awareness for our museums. But I think for the visitor, they get to see some really unique, quaint, beautiful little museums The North Point Lighthouse is a museum now, and the Jewish Museum Milwaukee is a terrific little museum that very few people know about unless you, you know, dig it up and look. So the Mile really was this opportunity to be able to bring all these museums together and market as one.
Well, and I imagine there's some concession here that many of these museums, these are not places that you go and spend an entire day the way you would at a much larger museum, one of the big institutions in Milwaukee or Chicago or whatever.
Well, I think one of the advantages, too, the other advantage is that it's affordable and it's local. And we like to say five great museums, one easy destination. So, you know, people can come into the east side and be able to see all of these museums on an afternoon, as a matter of fact. So you can spend an hour at one and an hour at another. Make a day of it, actually, when you come in for the weekend.
Well, and so you mentioned the sixth annual Milwaukee Museum Mile Day.
Correct.
Is Sunday, Mother's Day.
Absolutely.
But it also comes in the middle of a longer kind of, I don't know if observance is the right word, but a longer kind of event called the Plein Air.
Yes. So this is our second annual Art in the City Plein Air MKE 2017 event. We ran the first one last year. It was very successful. The idea behind the Plein Air event was that we wanted to build off the success of the Milwaukee Museum Mile and create some kind of signature event on the east side that would attract visitors from not just our neighborhoods, but also from around the region, you know, out in the suburbs, even beyond, even Chicago. And we often get many visitors that come in from out of state or who are visiting the state as a result. So Plein Air was designed to leverage the Mile as a destination for the neighborhoods and businesses in our area, which is basically the historic east side. Our location goes from Juneau Avenue on the south all the way up to Lake Park, where the lighthouse is. And so what we wanted to do was kind of seek a two-way street where we work with local businesses to support what we're doing as a Museum Mile, but also in return help support their businesses by bringing in more people into the east side area.
So where do you see people, you know, is this an idea that, you know, someone might park, you know, at one end or another and just kind of find themselves, you know, meandering their way from one end to the other over the course of an afternoon?
Absolutely. So how we promote Milwaukee Museum Mile Day, which in this year happens to be nestled right in the middle of our Plein Air event for the first time. It's only the second time for Plein Air, but usually Museum Mile Day is a standalone event. But on that day, we really promote it as a place where an event where you can walk to all the museums. You know, the mile is roughly 2 miles, but it's all walkable, or if you have bikes, you know, you can hit each one of these museums all along the way.
So explain what the Plein Air part of it looks like and feels like.
So the Plein Air event is a concept. You know, basically it's an art competition and an art sale. And the idea behind the Plein Air event is kind of twofold. One is to raise money for our museums that we then funnel back into our marketing efforts. And then the other is to create kind of a placemaking, you know, event that is on the east side, you know, and attract people to the east side and to enjoy all the things that the east side has to offer. So how Plein Air works, it's a competition, essentially, and artists are invited to compete for up to $6,000 in prize money that we offer. And they compete from the 11th of May through the 17th of May. And then all art is turned in at that point. And then on the 18th of May, we're going to hold our second annual soiree where we award artists their prize money and have the art sale. And so what the event will do for people who are observing is they'll be able to see all these artists for 6-7 days painting along the east side at various places. In addition, this year, we've added a second what's called a quick paint. Now, a quick paint is actually a timed competition. The artists will have 2.5 hours to create a painting, and their canvases get stamped, then they have 2.5 hours, and they have to turn their painting in. There's a whole other set of awards for that event. We held one on Brady Street last year. It was very successful. The artists loved it. And we're holding a second one this year. We're doing Brady Street again. But on Mother's Day, we're also doing our second quick paint, which encompasses Prospect Avenue and North Avenue.
It's like the painting equivalent of Iron Chef here.
Yeah, it almost is. Yeah, and they, you know, the artists can put out maybe 2, maybe 3 paintings at a crack if they wanted to. It starts at 8 each morning and ends at 5.
Sounds great.
So the beauty of it is that people who are walking along the streets are coming to these neighborhoods, get to see these artists painting. They can interact with them. They can walk up to them. The artists love it when people, you know, socialize with them. And so it's a very neat event where, the other aspect too, Mitch, is that what we're trying to do is, you know, create this sort of urban environment, you know, sort of glorify and celebrate the urban environment that we're all in. And so the plein air, you know, for our, in our case, is really situated in a nice urban environment that is very good for the folks who live there.
The Museum Mile is very much of its place.
It definitely is. It's all about placemaking and attracting people to that destination.
Well, Kevin Walczak, I am sure it is not the last time we'll talk about the Milwaukee Museum Mile. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin Walczak is on the board of the North Point Lighthouse, one of the five members of the Milwaukee Museum Mile. The Coalition's Plein Art Competition runs through May 21st. You can learn more about the Plein Art Competition and the Milwaukee Museum Mile Day from links at WUWM.com.
Coming up ahead of Armed Forces Week, our Bubbler Talk series looks at the building once used as the induction center during the Vietnam War. That's when Lake Effect returns on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
Bubbler Talk, quenching Milwaukee's thirst for knowledge.
I'm WUWM's Marge Pitroff. This week's Bubbler Talk question, as we head into Armed Forces Week, comes from Vietnam veteran John Keppen.
What was the building that was used for the induction center during the Vietnam War? It's completely different than what it was back in 1968.
Maybe you can tell. John knows the answer. Well, at least part of the answer. The Milwaukee building he's talking about is in the now fashionable Third Ward, the white building across the street from the Milwaukee Public Market. John points to the door he entered before climbing to the sixth floor waiting room.
And I remember there, I was in there with 30 or 40 guys. We talked a little small talk, and then you'd start going to stations, and they had an eye station, a hearing station. There was a great room, and they made everybody duck walk. You would grab your ankles and duck walk. The doctors would be wanting to know if you could maintain your balance.
John says most of the guys bravely faced the prospect of going to Vietnam. Yet there were also some in the waiting room who tried to flunk the physical.
They would do things to raise their blood pressure, scratch their corneas so that your eyes were blurry.
John says more bravery and fear surfaced when military recruiters walked into the room looking for draftees who could help fill the day's enlistment quota.
The sergeant came out and he said, I need five people to join the Marine Corps. And so three guys volunteered, and then he said, I need two more volunteers. I'm just going to take two guys. And then he took one guy and he took another guy, and the guy started crying. And so somebody else stepped forward and said, I'll go instead.
An Army recruiter noted that John passed his physical.
And he said, you're going to get drafted in 2 months. So I'll give you 2 years regular Army if you leave today. I said, okay. I called my mom. I said, I'm not coming home. I called my dad. My dad was quite angry with me. And he said, I'll come and get you. And I said, Dad, I might as well go. It was kind of like duty, honor, and country for a lot of us that were working in Milwaukee, blue-collar working class.
John Keppen left the building and boarded a plane to Kentucky for basic training. So what takes place today on the sixth floor of the building now called the Mayor? Well, a company called Regis occupies the space, and it agreed to let us visit. So we asked another Vietnam vet to come along and share his recollections. You remember him. He worked at the radio station for a long time.
Hey, Bob, how are you?
Bob Bach. So I thought this is where the story would begin to reach its climax. But as we were walking toward the building, Bob said,
this is not where I went.
Instead, he points to the red brick building down the block,
which was referred to as the Induction Center, or AFES, Armed Forces Entrance and Examining Station.
Well, we still wanted to visit the sixth floor of the Mayor. On the way in, Bob tells me this used to be the VA Center before it moved to National Avenue. Today, the sixth floor, where hundreds of young Milwaukee men lined up for physicals for the Vietnam War, is a bustling office rental company. Spokesman Jared Michalecki gives us a tour.
We have, you know, offices by the hour, by the day. They come fully furnished.
I just wonder if the spirit of the place has changed, or it was always one of hope and looking forward. And
I was thinking the same thing. Is some of that energy propelling these new people forward in a positive way so that all of those others' lives kind of live on.
Our visit is over, so now Bob and I have to walk to the red brick building down the block.
Didn't look like this?
East St. Paul in 1968. It wasn't a very pretty place. It was a working space for the old warehouses. Many of them were beginning to fall apart. It's just a renaissance.
Bob vividly remembers arriving here when he was 17.
My dad brought me down here. There were some protesters out in front of the door. They were encouraging draftees and enlistees, as I was, not to go in. Change your mind. You still have time. Back away. We'll help you with counseling. We'll get you into draft deferment. My dad's a pretty big guy. He was 6'4". He kind of threw his shoulder around like this, sort of corralled me in toward this door, pulled the door open, and says, "See you later, Rob. If you press your face against the door, you can still see the old cement steps. Add to that these lines that would have been painted all through these stairwells of different colors, directing you to whichever floor you needed to report to." And toward the end of that day, they marched us into a room, and this was where we took what was called the Oath of Enlistment. You raise your right hand, "I, Robert Bach," and your training was about to unfold before you. Sometimes I wonder what happened to all of those guys. Intellectually, I know that some percentage never came home from Vietnam.
So the history these two buildings in Milwaukee's Third Ward hold is that they were the places thousands of young men had to report to be inducted into the Vietnam War. Why does our Bubbler Talk questioner John Keppen want more Milwaukeeans to know the military history of this now trendy neighborhood?
There's a whole generation of young men that went and served honorably, and they never have been given their credit that's due to them.
Bubbler Talk is a production of WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio and made possible by the Board Game Barrister, satisfying Milwaukee's thirst for fun with games, classic toys, and puzzles for all ages. Locations at Bayshore, Greenfield, South Milwaukee, and now Mayfair. Do you have a question about Milwaukee you want answered? Submit it to us at WUWM.com and maybe we'll quench your thirst for knowledge.
You might have a mom, she might be the bomb, but ain't nobody got a mom like mine. Her love's till the end, she's my best friend.
Mother's Day is a time to celebrate the many gifts our parents give us, and sometimes the gifts we've given them. Lake Effect SAS Pam Parker fondly remembers the gift she and her mom shared one bygone Mother's Day.
Mother's Day approaches, bringing back memories of my sister and I and an easy-bake oven cake presented to my mother in bed with purple Kool-Aid. She smiled and choked it all down. We laugh about it still. Have you ever considered that it's likely your mother who heard your first laugh? And your laughter is likely something she loved to hear. Her child's laughter fills a mother's heart with joy more easily than anything else. As a mom of grown young men, I miss my boys laughing together at the dinner table. It helped that I raised a couple of characters, rather comedic characters. I've been thinking about literary mothers, too, and the two who affected me most as a child are Marmee, Mrs. March from Little Women, and Carolyn Ingalls, before the television show, from the Little House books. To me, they both were amazing, full of love and very teacherly in a non-threatening way. I adored them. They were strong women, living in times and situations that required strength. But strength tempered with unconditional love created something else altogether for me, the ideal mom. In my life, I've been fortunate to spring from strong women. I have a family snapshot from my uncle's wedding in 1965 showing me as the unhappy flower girl. I was ill with a bladder infection and pouting a lot, partly because even though I was almost five, my mother insisted I had to wear rubber pants. She was right, of course, but I was far too old for rubber pants in my little mind and quite upset. I love this picture for so many reasons. My grandma, mother of the groom, looks happy, proud, and gently concerned about me with a gloved hand on my upper back. She's wearing a fur wrap, which I wonder if she owned or borrowed from someone. I remember her as frugal. My mother stands in a white sailor dress, wearing a hat that could be a basket for holding fruit. Her expression, a closed-mouth smile, beams with pride. She holds my hand with her white-gloved one, and her other arm is looped in her grandmother's arm, my great-grandmother. Mom and my babci, Polish for grandmother, share the same expression. There's another growing person in the photo. My baby brother is barely visible as a tiny bump under my mother's dress. It's a classic picture for the era. At mass and special occasions in 1965, women still wore hats and gloves. But more than fashion sings out for me in that photo. My great-grandmother lived the mythic American story, arriving through Ellis Island in the early 1900s. She outlived three of her daughters. My grandmother raised her family under difficult conditions after a divorce, at a time when divorces were scandalous. My father died when my mother was 39, leaving her with two daughters in college and a teenaged son. Life wasn't easy for these hardworking women, but they channeled Winston Churchill, never gave up, and taught by example about what perseverance means. We learn many things from our mothers. If we're lucky, we learn about unconditional love, about truth, about family and building lives with meaning. But I've been exceptionally lucky because as I look at this old photo, I am reminded that I spring from a bloodline with the motto, never quit, in my veins. That desire to persevere has pulled me through hardships, has kept me working at my craft of writing, and informs my decisions every day. It's the greatest gift my mother, her mother, and her grandmother could have given me.
Lake Effect essayist Pam Parker is a writer who lives in Wauwatosa. To read the full piece and check out more Lake Effect essays, head to WUWM.com.
Up next, a new musical is drawing inspiration from the mayhem at town halls throughout the country. That's when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio.
From our lexicon, ideally, certain terms should be erased. You cannot say, hey guys, when you're greeting your pals. Think of what that implies to the ones who are gals. Now please don't demur, not in this day and age, for you just might stir my moral outrage.
Yes, you might stir her.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Joy Powers. From Congress to City Hall, Americans are engaging in a heated national discussion, picking apart topics from climate change and the economy to gun control and health care, particularly at town halls where politicians aim to connect with their constituents. Tempers have flared.
Comedy writer Jason Powell has found inspiration in the tension. His new musical, Only We Know Best, uses town hall mayhem as a backdrop for the comedic production. Unlike his previous work, Powell's newest play aims for more depth beyond the laughs. He spoke with Lake Effect contributor Mayan Silver about what he hopes to accomplish with his production.
In a larger sense, if you want to talk about the theme of the show, what had really come to preoccupy my mind was there almost seems to be this taken-for-granted notion that the only way you could possibly be on the other side of the aisle is if there's something wrong with you, that, you know, almost like there's some intrinsic flaw in your brain. So the opening song is the same as the title. It's Only We Know Best, and it's basically everyone saying essentially that, you know, America's got a lot of problems, but luckily we know how to solve it. And, you know, and here are the problems. You know, there's fraud, there's corruption, there's stupidity, but fortunately only on the other side so we can fix it.
You can't possibly be suggesting that there's a disconnect between the right and left in the country, right?
No, I would never suggest such
a
thing.
Never imply that.
I had a friend who I've only met him in person once. We actually met online and became really good friends over just having similar tastes in pop culture before I don't know how long we had been friends before I realized that he was a pretty staunch Republican, and it really kind of took me back for a second because it was kind of, I felt like a perfect thing to happen to me. I'm really glad that it did because it snapped me out of that a little bit because I'd already come to respect him. He's very articulate. He's very smart. And so it really kind of snapped me for a second, like, because I realized how quickly I was almost ready to write him off as soon as I found out he was a Republican. Like, oh, I must have been wrong. I guess he's not intelligent and cool, you know. And I thought, what? Wait, that's not how it should be. And a lot of the content of this show came out of conversations with him. We sort of realized that we could have conversations about politics and even arguments, and that it was all cool. Like, no matter how heated it might get, we'd be friends at the end of it. And that kind of, I feel like, at least for me, gave me the freedom to really, you know, ask him questions, you know, challenge him on stuff. A lot of that ended up becoming kind of grist for the mill when I was sort of putting together, because in the show there are a lot of Republicans, a lot of Democrats.
Right. So it's a town hall setting, and, you know, characters come in, and that's a really big hot spot in our country today and in recent times. And you have a bunch of different songs. Can you just tell us about kind of the layout of the musical?
It's not the most plot-driven musical you'll ever see. It's very much, I've kind of compared it to stuff like A Chorus Line, which, if you're not familiar, is essentially just a line of people all auditioning for a show, and it's one of them steps forward and it's like, oh, I'm going to ask you a few questions about why you want to be in the show or how you got your start as an actor. And then they just sing a song or do a monologue. And then, all right, number two, now let's hear from you. And so there's no real plot. There are like a few small or short character arcs, but certainly not a lot of twists and turns or anything like that.
You know, there's different characters, and some of them are from the left, some of them are from the right, stereotypically, or representative of what one side in particular thinks of the other. And, you know, I wanted to ask you about this one called The Climate Change Cha-Cha.
Listen to me, I'm a scientist, and just like you, I've certainly noticed more and more it's becoming the norm for our globe to be luxuriously warm. Oh, feel the hot, hot.
So, you know, it's really, when I heard the title of that, I kind of was expecting something upbeat Latin rhythms, you know, and then ultimately the song is a little bit somber with piano and some tambourine, but then you have someone say cha-cha-cha, and it kind of and it kind of adds some levity.
Please, let's all get together and enjoy the weather in the shade. It's 100 degrees, cha-cha-cha.
But it's very cleverly written. Can you tell me a little bit about that one?
Sure, yeah. It was a couple things. You know, I was kind of looking for ways to treat these different topics with comedy. And it was, my friend that I was just talking about, Jay, he may have pointed, because he knew I was working on the show, and he kind of pointed me towards articles, specifically stuff that dealt with the scientists who deny it or you know, who are kind of downplaying, you know, how much humanity or mankind is contributing to it. And somebody, and I like I said, I don't remember his name, but there's a quote where he talks about how this extra layer of CO2 is, it'll be like a nice warm jacket that you slip on. And I thought, wow, that's really, really defending it. And that kind of became the basis. There's a line in the song.
Yes.
The sensation of elevated CO2 is like a soft blanket wrapped around you. You can believe all of these.
That kind of was the seed. And I thought, oh, you know, a cha-cha, you know, has a kind of tropical beat. And so just that's where the whole idea came from of celebrating how nice and luxuriously warm the country is getting.
Yeah, that's funny. And then, you know, you find out that this guy who's singing the song, the scientist, is actually, I mean, I don't want to spoiler alert, but right. He's kind of in the pockets of some corporations, actually.
And that went back to a really long, like my first sort of encounter with the issue. Another Republican friend of mine who had a blog and linked to this scientist who was saying, you know, the reason for this whole orthodox notion about mankind contributing to climate change is scientists have to kind of like toe the line if they want to get grants and stuff. They have to say that they believe that. A lot of these scientists don't even really think that. And I thought, oh, is that true? And then someone sort of gave me, you know, the guy who's saying that gets millions of dollars a year from oil companies because he goes around, he does these lectures in these boardrooms.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, okay, so that, So that's kind of where that idea came from.
And I wanted to ask you about the title for that one, Climate Change Cha-Cha. I mean, if someone's sidestepping or towing an issue, it's kind of like they're cha-cha-ing around the issue,
right.
You know? So I kind of thought that that was very clever of you, too.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, it was one of those things that every song in the show, I mean, I shared with you a couple songs, of course, and I tried to make every song on the show its own kind of musical genre. And there's a lot of fun in kind of trying to match a genre to an issue, and so many Latin flavored songs kind of have this sort of invocation of heat, you know. It's sort of it's getting hot, ha, ha,
yeah.
Hot, you know. And sort of, it seemed like a perfect fit somehow.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, totally. And it's kind of like you said, the big point of this, a big point of the show is equal opportunity skewering, right? I mean, you're trying to poke fun at pretty much everybody. Nobody's exempt.
More or less, yeah. I think at the end of the day, it's probably like a two-thirds ratio. I probably make fun of Republicans maybe twice as much. But
right,
it's kind
okay.
of a two. But that said, part of that too was that it felt like that was more interesting material to explore because it deliberately forced me to think in terms that I don't usually think in. Sometimes it seemed like to do a song from the point of view of the left was so obvious, and not to make assumptions about who's going to see the show, but a lot of people who come to see theater probably be a little left-leaning, and so I sort of wanted to do more things that were kind of in an interesting, in the opposite camp, you know, and kind of getting inside those kind of mindsets. There's a song about coal mining companies and communities. There are entire communities in parts of the country that when people talk about the coal industry and how the EPA's regulations kind of put such a damper on it, and it was an issue where it seemed like the left was surprisingly uncompassionate to my mind, and made me wonder how many people realize that, you know, this is not just one guy over here and one guy over here losing his job. There are entire communities where everyone who lives in that community, their job is at the coal mine or, you know, the coal factory.
Yeah. Makes me wonder, how is it so easy for you to find the humor in these situations? How do you zero in on that?
Oh, well, I guess I just follow the model of anything from, you know, the Colbert Report to Weekend Update or political comedians.
Saturday Night Live. And,
yeah, any of that stuff that just kind of satirizes things. And,
yeah.
And it just seems like a good way, you know, if part of the issue that you know, again, going back to the title and the we know best and the sort of arrogance of that notion that the other side is all fools and we're all right, it almost seems like humor is the best way to kind of pierce that a little bit, you know. And
yeah.
You know, for better or for worse. And again, you can't second guess what people are gonna do, you know.
Sure.
I don't know if people are going to come and say, this is not, you shouldn't be joking about this stuff. You know,
right,
I don't know. You
right.
know, to my mind, it just seems like the best way to deal with it.
Yeah.
And it's where my mind goes anyway, is just to, you know, I prefer a musical comedy to a musical drama. So.
Well, on that note, you did bring your guitar and you have a piece about something that not too many people joke about, capital punishment.
Well, it's, yeah, this is one of those, I guess you could argue this is kind of in a gray area because it's not, I don't know that it's quite funny, but it's, and doing it today with just me, it's actually a bit of a sing-along. It's in that Cab Calloway style of singing something and then have the audience kind of sing it back to you.
Folks, I'm gonna lay it out simple and plain. Murderers and rapists are society's bane. If you think that punishment should be humane, then I'll come back with one straightforward refrain. Oh, don't do the crime if you can't do the time. Don't do the crime if you can't do the time. I'm not saying that jail should not rehabilitate. Some who go crooked can still be set straight. But if you like to murder and mutilate, then sorry son, you've earned a less merciful fate. Oh, don't do the crime if you can't do the time.
if you can't do the time. On basic human rights we all can agree. Life and liberty belong to everybody. But if you break the law, you lose liberty. So if you also lose life, that's fine with me. So don't do the crime if you can't do the time. Don't do the crime if you can't do the time. I've heard the logic that liberals prefer. Killing killers is illogical. It doesn't deter. You want to save the life of some murderer? Go find the victim's daughter and explain it to her.
Wow, that was really cool.
Thank you. So that one kind of is more, it's upbeat and then it kind of takes a little turn at the end.
Yes, interesting. And, you know, I'm seeing it. I'm kind of picturing it, like people stepping up forward at this town hall and singing their piece. And the lyrics are very engaged with the issues that are going on, you know, with things that are going on with people.
To me, it comes back to that idea of just remembering that the people on the other side of the debate are still human beings. And whatever they might believe, you know, even though you might think it's misguided, you know, they, for the most part, at least if you're talking, I mean, obviously there are politicians who are corrupt and who have been bought and sold by whoever. I realize that. And that's true on both sides of the aisle, too. But, you know, people like you and me are just, you know, everyday people who are not in the business of politics, but just have our opinions. We've all come in by them, honestly. And it's not like anyone wants the worst thing for the country. And everyone really, and that, I guess that's the other aspect of the title of the connotations of a word like best, you know, is that, you know, we want the positive thing. We all want what is best for the country and for people. And, you know, if people have the opposite opinion from you, it's not because they want the worst for people. You know, whatever they think that it's the best thing too. And I guess you're, again, coming back to the humor of it and doing a show that's comedic. Hopefully, I don't know, laughter is a way to sort of maybe get everybody in a more jovial mood and maybe thinking more warmly about people they disagree with.
Cool. Well, Jason Powell, thanks for spreading the smiles, and thanks for coming on Lake Effect and talking about your musical comedy.
Thank you very much for having me.
Writer and actor Jason Powell's newest musical comedy is called Only We Know Best. It's presented by Milwaukee Metro Voices and opens Friday night at Next Act Theater. And that's Friday's edition of the show. I'm Joy Powers.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks so much for tuning in today, and please be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next.